Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Doug Sovereign, political reporter at KCBS Radio in San Francisco, your moderator for this program. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. You can download the iPhone or Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker this evening, Richard Wolff, MSNBC political analyst, former senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He's the author of the new book, The Message, The Reselling of President Obama, which is getting a lot of attention. Richard Wolff is originally from England. He's a graduate of Oxford University. He worked as a reporter at the Financial Times covering Washington, D.C. Then he moved to Newsweek, first as diplomatic correspondent, then covering presidential politics. He covered the Howard Dean campaign, the John Kerry campaign, and, of course, the historic Obama presidential campaign in 2008. He became Newsweek's senior White House correspondent. He appears frequently on MSNBC. You may see him there pretty often. He's now executive editor of MSNBC.com. He's the best-selling author of three books, all of them about Barack Obama, Renegade, Revival, and now The Message. Please welcome Richard Wolff.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming out tonight. I feel like I should use this, but I won't. So let me tell you some of the backstory to the book before we get into your questions, because my experience at the Commonwealth Club has always been great, and I know that you all have lots of questions in you and want to leave a lot of time for that. It's been a long journey getting to this point. I started out covering President Obama when he was this long shot candidate in early 2007. And at the time, there were lots of people who really didn't give him much chance. Lots of very smart people, pundits, insiders, journalists, who said he'd never make it. And I got to know him and his inner circle, his team of strategists and consultants, all the people who really packaged him together for that first time, that extraordinary rise. And I went back to my editors at Newsweek and said, this guy's for real. I mean, there's something really going on here, and you need to pay attention to Iowa and everywhere else, and but especially Iowa, and especially to this incredible spirit they have and the people who are showing up and the strategy that they've got, especially the strategy. And, of course, they told me I was a stupid foreign idiot and to go away and not come back again. So the day after, actually the night he won in Iowa, obviously everyone changed their minds, and the journey sort of gathered pace. And, of course, it wasn't easy at that point. It was fraught. There were lots of stumbles along the way. But soon after that first win, the first couple of wins, then Senator Obama came to me and said, you know, you should write a book. And that book, which initially I told him was a stupid idea, that book, I really did tell him it was a stupid idea. That book turned into Renegade, and after I did Renegade, I was fascinated by the struggles they had in the White House that first couple of years, and especially by something which is quite familiar right now, which is the idea that people wrote him off for dead. The healthcare battle started out sort of hopeful and then dragged on, and then they lost the Massachusetts seat. And at that point, everyone said the presidency was over. And then 2 months later, they passed health care into law. And they seem to always just be passing it into law. I mean, now it's about to become a reality. This time it's for real. But I was fascinated by that arc, and I wrote Revival on the back of that, and really tried in that book to get to grips with the sharp differences of opinion in the White House. Every White House has a divide in it. Now, the Bush White House had the hawks and the doves, and I wanted to figure out what were the disputes really going on? What was the debate at the heart of the Obama White House? And it turned out to be broadly campaign people, people who believed in the campaign, who wanted to go in and reform Washington and do things differently, and those who were the Washington insiders. And that was the tension. It was played out all the way through healthcare. Do they do the backroom deals? Do they take it to the country? You know, do they just look for senator votes, or are they more aggressive? That whole tension. Do they have lobbyists or not? What was the Obama spirit? And that tension was playing out inside the president too. So I was trying to get to that with that book. Campaigns, though, are irresistible. And with this third book, and I promise you, there'll be no more. with this third book, I really wanted to build on those first two and round out the story. I'd always thought there was going to be a third book. I thought it might come at the end of the second term, but it felt like this was the moment. And it was the moment for a couple of reasons. First of all, I wanted to have a sort of parallel and an echo, a compare and contrast with the first round. Because that campaign was so special in 2008, and because it was their story of that journey, in looking at how things had changed and whether they'd changed and what had happened. So there was a sort of neat echo there, and there was a neat extension of the struggles of the first term as it played out with this campaign. Now, there was something else going on for me as well, which is that the first book was subtitled The Making of a President, obviously an echo of Teddy White. This book, The Reselling of the President, was really an echo of the Joe McGinnis book. I'm sure many of you read it, an even smaller book than my book. And what Joe did brilliantly in that book, and it's been a bit of a subject, a sore point for academics who look at political history. But what he did in that book was assert that the Nixon campaign in 68 was groundbreaking because of the use of TV advertising. Now, that's not entirely true. TV advertising had really embedded itself in American political culture for a couple of cycles before then. But Joe got right into the heart of that campaign, led by one Roger Ailes, the creator of Fox News. It's not the only time I'm going to say that. And he really was an instrumental figure in packaging up Nixon, repackaging Nixon. So I wanted to look at those themes as well, because a reelect, in many ways, the repackaging of Nixon was itself a sort of reelect. Of course, he was well known; they had to reinvent him. But a reelect is really it's no longer about biography. It's no longer about who is Barack Obama or what does he stand for. It really was, and always is with a presidential reelection, about repackaging, marketing, especially advertising. So I wanted to look at the ad team. I wanted to look at how those tensions replayed. I wanted to play off the Joe McGinnis book. And I felt that this was one of those arcs, again, where people had said he was finished. No president could ever get reelected with unemployment so high. He was surely finished. And indeed, all of the research that they had inside the campaign suggested pretty much that it was very bleak. Their focus grouping and polling at the start of the campaign came off the last debt ceiling crisis. You may have tried to forget it, but it did happen, and it was a disaster, and voters were more than ready for change. They were really, really unhappy with the whole political system, but especially with the president. So it was one of those unlikely journeys, a tremendous achievement to overcome all of those hurdles, opponents who are always going to outspend them. So I felt that was a great story as well. You know, we knew that they won. How did they overcome it? What I wasn't expecting, was to, as I reported out the story, hear just how difficult it had been for the Obama team inside Chicago and inside the White House. Not because of these external challenges, but because of their internal politics. One thing that wasn't true in 2007, 2008, was the kind of infighting that is so typical of other campaigns. It really was a shock to me. They'd done a very good job of maintaining the sort of glow of 2008 and saying they're all in it together, there was a great team spirit, and in fact, there wasn't. So for me, they had to overcome this incredible challenge of the economy, they had to overcome this formidable money machine on the other side. But they also had to overcome each other, and that was a big surprise to me. that tells you something about the stresses and strains of trying to run a country and a campaign in such difficult circumstances. It tells you something about President Obama and fills out that picture too, I think, about his leadership. Maybe it explains something about the situation we're now in. But it also suggests there's a way out if they choose it. I mean, one of the interesting points that was raised to me was, how come there are really no campaign people who've gone into this second term? How come there really isn't any fresh blood? How come the president likes to hear debate about policy but not about politics or communication? How come he's had such a hard time with his own message? And there were things that were incredible about the 2012 campaign. Reimagining the campaign as they did, not being about Mitt Romney, but being about the economy, an economy that doesn't work for the middle class, was a brilliant move and actually a very genuine move, a very important debate to have. There were other parts of the campaign that really surprised me because I'd read so much and I'd heard so much about how brilliant things were. We're right here at the spiritual heart of the tech industry. And I'd read in lots of places how awesome the Obama tech machine was. And parts of it really were awesome. Completely groundbreaking. Not just the grassroots, but the analytics, how they put together this incredible database of all voters, ranking them on a range of 1 to 100 of whether they were likely to vote for Obama or Romney. 100 was an Obama vote, a Romney was a 1 was a certain Romney vote. And they tried to segment it, so they were just looking at the sort of 45-55 range. I mean, and there were several thousand elements that were going into that 100 range of scoring. Nobody's ever done anything like that. Nobody's ever been able to buy ads looking at that voter number range. So you look at that and you say, these guys are just all brilliant. But one of my jobs now, as Doug pointed out, is looking at the whole digital piece for MSNBC. And the umbrella of tech contains many things. And at the heart of it, there was this giant argument between people who were very political, like these guys doing the segmenting, and the tech guys who were building all the tools who had nothing to do with politics. The guy running it had come from a t-shirt company. And they took pride in that. He was recruited because he had no experience in politics. And guess what? The political people didn't have any respect for him and thought he didn't understand them. And he didn't have any respect for them because he thought, I'm not sure I can use this word. He had a very low regard for them. Extremely low regard. Now, the reaction to the book has been fascinating to me. I know that I'm very aware that there are Obama fans who don't want to hear any more about any problems or challenges, and they would like to think that 2012 was a perfect glide path to victory. I think the real picture is a little more nuanced and actually all the more of an achievement as a result. The tech team was a year late on some of its major projects, and yet they still trounced the other side. The communications team couldn't communicate with each other, weren't on speaking terms, and yet they still delivered the most powerful message that overcame a desperately struggling economy. So I find the story of the message even more impressive for the problems that they had to overcome. Nothing about this president has ever been a smooth path. It wasn't in 2008. I know people want to think it was that, but it really wasn't. He lost many times. He stumbled many times. His presidency hasn't been that. And it shouldn't be a surprise, although it wasn't reported, but it shouldn't be a surprise that the 2012 campaign wasn't like that either. It's certainly not like that now with his presidency, although one week everyone says he's a disaster in foreign policy, and now apparently he's brilliant in foreign policy. So the pundits have, you know, sometimes that we should have a sort of ranking of you know, what you've said and do you actually stick with it from one week to another, but that's a whole other debate. I will just give you one piece of news, just because you've all showed up tonight, and that's wonderful. So I haven't told people this, but the reaction from the inside people has been really eye-opening to me. I mean, I thought reporting the book was eye-opening, and I really haven't told people this, so So you're hearing this for the first time. But I've been getting emails from all the people who I interviewed, and you know, they were very concerned that the book was, you know, they knew that I'd figured stuff out that they'd tried to keep secret, and they didn't know where it would go and who was spinning against who. So the emails, as they start reading the book, are fascinating. One of the... So I'm going to give you some. Well, they didn't tell me not to say anything, but anyway. So one of them said, and I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly. You may have heard, there was... I reported for the first time that there was a plot to fire the deputy campaign manager, Stephanie Kessel, one of the highest profile people on the campaign, the single highest profile woman on the campaign, apart from Michelle Obama. So one of the plotters emailed me and said, I can't believe you got this, because we were all sworn to secrecy. And if it ever came out, we would all look bad. So congratulations. That was I liked that one. That was a nice one, because it didn't actually hold me in low regard. That was one. I got several emails from Stephanie Kessel herself, who's now gone on to great success at CNN. She urged me to be more public in my fingering of the people to blame, which was a sort of roundabout way of confirming everything. I told her, actually, you know, you have this platform at CNN. Really, you can also, if you want, go out and finger the people who are to blame, since we all know who they were, and I name them in the book. That was several very, very long emails. Someone else, very senior in the White House, emailed me to say, you do realize that our biggest problem with this book is that it's all true. So with that, I'm going to open it up to your questions, and I hope you take the time to read the book. It's not a hugely long read. Everyone's very busy, but I try to make all my books a clean and simple read, even if people think I'm superficial. So thank you for coming tonight.
Good job. Our thanks to Richard Wolff, MSNBC political analyst, executive editor, MSNBC.com, author of the new book, The Message, The Reselling of President Obama, which he's just been telling you about. And now it's time for our audience question period. We have a lot of questions and plenty of time, so we should get to a lot of them. So let's begin. A number of people would like to know how you put together a book like this. How do you get these people to talk to you? Obviously, you've done it before. This wasn't the first one, but let's start with that. How do you go about it?
So this book, or every book I found, is very different. This book had some particular challenges, which I actually weave into the book as well. Early on in the project, the White House, at pretty much the highest level, decided they would have a no-book policy. Mm-hmm. Now, this is a challenge to book authors. It's also ludicrous, because, as I pointed out to them, it's a bit like having a no newspaper policy. I mean, how do you enforce that? We're all going to write our books anyway. I told Stephanie Kessel that early on, and she looked at me like she was about to rip my head off, which I think is probably her signature look. And she said, that's just not going to work with this team. You've got to understand. Of course, I knew the team very well, and they said, look, it's not about you. Something happened. And they wouldn't tell me what. So that piqued my curiosity, and I found out what happened. There was an early strategy meeting, super secret, double secret strategy meeting, early on in the White House with a fairly large group of consultants and strategists, but all of them on the payroll, all of them dedicated to reelecting the president. And the meeting leaked to some journalists almost immediately. And, of course, those journalists, normally if you get a really good leak, you don't blab about it immediately. I mean, you know, it's stupid to leak, but it's even more stupid to leak your leak. Mm-hmm. And that's what these people did. And it went straight back into this mix, and it went straight up to the president. And so the next week, he calls everyone back in. It's supposed to be a weekly meeting. And he's pissed as hell. And he says, if I can't trust you, then who can I trust? What are you here for? And he walks out. And by the way, he only walks out in a stage thing. I mean, you know, he has such a tight control of his emotions that, you know, it's a performance. So Joe Biden, they've obviously worked out a tag team, then stands up and says, you know, the president's really, really disappointed in you. And he walks out. So you do it. So I tell this story in the book, because what then happens is that this group of strategists and consultants turn on each other. In the absence of the teacher and the assistant teacher, they start fingering each other and going, well, it wasn't me. I would never do any such thing. And I'm so loyal. I cannot believe anyone. And there becomes this competition of who is the most loyal and who is the most outraged. And it's clearly one of the most outraged people is probably the leaker. Mm-hmm. At which point, Robert Gibbs, God bless him, who had no reason to really go out and defend the president, given that he'd been kind of pushed out, but had every reason to hate everyone in that room because he'd been kind of pushed out, he then rips into them. I mean, completely rips into them, F-bombs everywhere, and says, we never would have done anything like this in 2007-08. And that's true. So the meetings get smaller, and they never have any other leaks. So by the process of elimination, they figure out, you know, they can kind of guess who it was. But the end result is they come out saying, no books. If we have these books, then people are going to leak all the internal strategy. So books are going to have to wait until after the election, and then you can do what you like. So it wasn't really a no-book policy. It was a wait-to-write-your-book policy. Now, that's just very frustrating and annoying for people like me, where they say, we're going to talk to you, but just wait. So I did a lot of reporting at the time, surreptitiously, quietly, on the sides, in Chicago, drag people off campus, that kind of thing. So part of the book is real time, and a fair amount of the book, all the juicy stuff, honestly, is reconstructed because, you know, the truth is, if it's really problematic at the time, they really know not to talk about it. And that was true in the first book as well. I was present for much more of that campaign because, you know, when the candidate is on the road every day, all day, then you've got much more reason to travel. When they're a president traveling, you don't even have a contact with them. You can be on Air Force One on every single trip, and you're literally by the toilet. Mm-hmm. And the president is so far away, and he has, you know, the suite and the bedroom and the conference room, and you never see him. So this book relied much more on the post-election interviews, and really sort of pulling on threads of saying, wait a second. I'll be honest with you, some of the best stuff emerged because I initially misunderstood things really badly. And I would present my conclusion to someone who'd then say, no, you got it all wrong. It didn't happen like that. It happened like this. Oh, I shouldn't have told you.
So that's a good strategy.
It's a great, if I'd known, I'd have got things wrong much earlier. But it's a kind of like a kind of Columbo thing. My first news editor always said, you should be like Columbo. You should always kind of be kind of clueless and then say, oh, you know, just one more thing. And I felt like...
Generally my approach.
I worked hard to be clueless.
It does seem, though, that political players, I mean, they're eager to talk to authors like you and spill an awful lot after the fact. I mean, these books always come out, the Clintons were notoriously ran a pretty tight ship, and things still do come out. Why is that? What is the nature of that profession where people say, hey, let me tell you what really happened?
The interviews didn't really start like that. I mean, this one really was layer on layer, one interview leading to another, going back to people several times. I can tell you that the initial round of interviews were all about how this was the world's best team and they all loved each other and they could think of nothing more than working with each other for the rest of their lives. And you go, yeah, that's a little bit excessive. But and then, you know, 5 minutes later when you present them with some outrage, they go, yeah, they were terrible and I wanted to get him fired. Mm-hmm. And so I think what surprises me the most was that here was a campaign in 2007-08 that really defined themselves as being the anti-Clinton, the non-Clinton. Mm-hmm. And the cliche now is, oh, they're just like Bush. They're not like Bush, actually. They've ended up being like the Clinton operations, mm-hmm. with these factions and personal rivalries and people getting pushed out but not really pushed out. Mm-hmm. And is there something about democratic strategists that leads them down this track? I think that's like beyond my level of psychobabble.
Isn't a presidential campaign, though, and the kind of operation that it is, by its very nature, prone to attracting these alpha dogs, big
yes.
ego,
yes.
strong personalities? And if you have more than one, there's going to be clashes inevitably.
Yeah, so maybe the weird thing was 2008. Right. Maybe the weird
was
thing
the
was that they subsumed their egos because they, you know, one way to look at it was that they had really nothing to lose. They were more willing to embrace risk because they didn't really believe they were going to do it. And I think this time around, the fear of losing was that much greater. The prospect of losing was that much more real. And so I think part of those tensions were playing out. But also you've got baggage from being in the White House and losing arguments and struggling against the Tea Party and struggling against the economy. And people screwing up. I mean, let's be honest. They were self-inflicted mistakes, both before the campaign and during the campaign, and all of those things lead to this kind of fraying of long-standing relationships. And I think none of them surprised me more than how David Axelrod, who really did more than anyone to sort of shape this president as a candidate and his message and his story, kind of gets pushed to the outer ring in being sort of sent off to Chicago. It's his hometown. He wanted to get back. He wanted to be closer with his family. All of that's true. But he was still on the outer ring. And being on the outer ring, having been on the inner ring, was a difficult transition for me. And I think that was shocking to many people in the Obama orbit, that if David Axelrod could get edged out like that, then that meant all of them mm-hmm. could and would be. You know, when they find out that loyalty is a one-way street, it's a chilling moment.
How come so many politicians who are so good at getting elected have so much trouble governing? Mm. The skills to do one, I guess, aren't necessarily the same as the other, and the opposition is different in a yep. race than it is in Washington. But why is that?
So the White House people will say, well, it's much easier for campaigns because they have hundreds of millions of dollars to put behind every message and they can have message discipline, whereas we poor things, we are, you know, battered by events and all, and, you know, the Tea Party and this determined opposition. It's a kind of fatalistic view that they have in the White House, I'll be honest. You know, if you ask them, how come you're still struggling all these years later to explain healthcare, they'll say, well, healthcare is very complicated. Well, yeah, but you've been at it for years, and you've actually sunk several hundreds of millions of dollars into it as well. So I think there are, it becomes a sort of crutch. What they've had is, in the first term, lots of people who thought they could do messaging, who all thought they were brilliant at it, and no real direction as a result. That's the president, the first lady, Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs. You're going to have that many people mm-hmm. thinking they're running the message. In a campaign, there were lots of people thinking they could run the message, but in the end, there was only one set of ads that they could release at any one time, so things kind of got funneled down. But here you're in a situation again where, you know, they have an agenda. They got elected on an agenda, and it's very hard for them to get back to that when, you know, the president's trying to talk about Syria in one way or another. He's trying to talk about gun control in one way or another. And yet, he's also trying to hit on the economy as well and these long-term structural challenges for the economy. And I do think that's going to be a debate that the next election, the next Democratic nominee is going to have to talk about as well. So why is it hard? Well, governing in these circumstances is hard. But I also think that the team still is finding the message very, very hard.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Richard Wolff, MSNBC political analyst and author. We're discussing the inside workings of the Obama campaign and administration. You brought up health care reform, so let's talk about that for a second. Are you surprised that 4 years later, this is a battle again, that on the eve of it actually taking effect, people are talking again about repealing it, defunding it, using
after
it as a wedge?
After 40 votes to repeal it.
Exactly. A battle that the president probably thought was done and won.
Yeah, I am surprised that Republicans still feel that there is some mileage in having another vote for repeal. I'm surprised they still draw some energy from a debate that is really settled. I'm surprised they still feel that they can somehow box in this president. Now, the truth is that there are bigger structural problems that the Republicans have. They allowed the Tea Party to, which was really a separate group, rather than sort of wither on its own like the sort of Ross Perot Republicans, they have embraced them and they find it very hard to reconcile two very different directions. So that's what's playing out right now. They know Ted Cruz's strategy is not going to work. They're increasingly saying that, but they have to play along to a degree. That's a surprise. I would have thought by now the more sane voices, the people who actually look at polls and have to win statewide as opposed to just in certain districts, would say, you know, this is really hurting us. And they have a chance, as they did in 2010, to win back the Senate. If they carry on embracing this stuff, they're not going to choose the right candidates again, and they will miss another opportunity to take back the Senate. So that does surprise me. Does it surprise me that the Obama campaign is still struggling to express what this policy means? Yes, that surprises me too. It's Groundhog Day, and I've heard Democrats who really support this president and who really love health care reform say, "I'm sick of it. I'm sick of the whole thing." If that's the goal of the Tea Party folks, to increase the number of people who are sick of politics, they have succeeded. I cannot bring myself to believe that that is their purpose. So. I think Republicans are talking to themselves, and I'm not exactly sure who Democrats are talking to.
We have a packet of questions here, a series about the 2012 campaign,
yes.
A number on the 2016.
I should speed up.
Some, no, that's okay. And some on the 2016, so I'm going to sort of organize them into groups. But here's one you might enjoy. Is it not the case that strategy and message be damned? Obama's opponents in the Republican primaries were mostly clowns, and the survivor was a stiff. What would have happened had Obama had a worthy opponent and not Mitt Romney?
Well, I think he's been blessed by really, truly incompetent opponents. I mean, it's like he's running against Alan Keyes for Senate.
That's true.
You know, the Romney campaign, for all the problems of the Obama campaign, the Romney campaign, their apps crashed on Election Day. I mean, really, the people couldn't tie their own shoelaces. And I was having dinner with a really senior Romney advisor just this past weekend, and I said, you do realize you hit on some really powerful messages that the Obama campaign was worried about. And I write about this in the book. You know, the idea that voters had had high hopes for him, but they were disappointed, and really maybe it was time for a change. That was almost directly from the focus groups that the Obama people were hearing and the Romney people too. And they were really powerful ads. And why didn't you stick with them? And he said, well, you know why we didn't stick with them. Because they weren't our ads. They were actually the Karl Rove Group ads. So they didn't have any focus. They had worse messaging. What would have happened if they'd had a competent campaign? A close race would have been really on a knife edge. I still think on balance, you know, the president had some talent and strength that really would have overwhelmed other candidates. Who would it have been that time around? It's very hard to kick out an incumbent president with such a tremendous grassroots operation. There were parts of the campaign, mostly stovepiped, that were really truly groundbreaking. The grassroots effort, the demographics changes, the president's personability, his likability, his smarts, his talent as a campaigner, those tilt the balance towards him. But no question, he was helped by having, and blessed by having, such truly dismal opponents.
The Romney campaign, I mean, I've covered these campaigns as well. The Romney campaign reminded me a lot of the Kerry campaign.
Yeah.
In terms of the way it was run, in terms of the candidate.
Yep.
Does it take sometimes, I mean, you just have to get lucky and come up against an opponent who you know you can beat?
Yeah, of course, the alternatives were even worse, right? I mean, Rick Perry was a guy who couldn't remember three things.
Two,
right?
You only remember two.
And he is, God bless him, trying to run again, which is going to be very entertaining. So, you know, the people who didn't run, I think, are the ones who would kick themselves. And that was true in the Kerry cycle, too. I mean, when you have those serious Democrats, people like Joe Biden, who looked at Howard Dean coming in and thinking, that that should have been my moment. Mm-hmm. They felt the same in 92 as well, mm-hmm. you know, and they looked at Bill Clinton and they said, is Bill Clinton's turn? Really? So, you know, deciding to run, and this is why I started Renegade with this, deciding to run is the hardest decision of all, unless you're a complete idiot, in which case it's really easy. And obviously there were several of those in this cycle.
Do you think there was a particular turning point for Obama against Romney? Was it the 47% video? Or were there a series of them? Or do you think there was never really a point, panicky Democrats aside and true believer Republicans aside, when it was really in jeopardy?
One of the shocking things that I realized during this book, and I looked at their the internal polling, and I put this throughout the book, the race was remarkably stable. I mean, it really ended up where it started out. You know, some of the proportions of voters shifted, the number of younger voters, the sort of independent, infrequent women voters. Those numbers changed internally, but honestly, the race was almost static. And 47% was a high watermark for Obama, or rather, actually, it was just a really low watermark for Romney. Mm. The president's numbers really didn't bump. They didn't change. They went from 48 and 49 to 50, or 51 and back to 50. I mean, it was really a very, very narrow range. And these are polls of the battleground states and really focusing on the crucial band, that slice of voters, the 45 to 55 in that internal ranking. They didn't really move, which begs the question, what did you get for your $1 billion of advertising? Mm-hmm. So was there one thing?
You shored yourself up.
Yeah, well, they'll say, oh, well, that's a kind of ridiculous argument. If we hadn't spent $1 billion, then the whole race would have been different. But it's like saying, well, if we hadn't stationed, you know, 100,000 troops in Central Europe, maybe the Russians would have invaded. Well, yeah, maybe. But did it have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars and almost, you know, destroy the planet? I don't know. Was it worth it? Question from the floor.
We're getting rowdy.
San Francisco.
Feel free to write it down.
Why did Romney think he was going to
win? Actually, that's a very good question, because having covered the campaign, the Romney people were truly surprised and disappointed that they didn't win. They really thought, I mean, he didn't write a concession speech. They really thought they were going to win, and there was never a point where I thought he was going to win.
Yeah, so their polling was one of the most incompetent parts of their campaign. And there was a lot of competition for that. But their polling, they could not believe, they could not accept a makeup of the vote. So, mm-hmm. you know, you go out and you poll 1,000 people, and you could just take the raw 1,000 people. You take 1,000 people at random, and you could say, well, it's just 1,000 people, that's what it is. But what they end up doing is normally reweighting, right? They're going to look for certain people in certain states, so it's not just a random 1,000 people across the country. They look for 1,000 people and they say, yeah, but we've got to reweight it because we haven't got young people, because this was just a landline-based poll, so we've got to reweight it slightly for young people. And then you start playing around at the edges. And they could not believe the makeup of these polls were going to be anything like 2008. I mean, how could it be after 2010 that African-American voters would show up in similar numbers? Impossible to imagine. Mm-hmm. How could it be that the demographics of the country could change, even though the census has suggested they had? They couldn't accept those fundamentals. And if you don't accept those fundamentals, you start tinkering with the numbers, basically because you are biased. Right. And as it turned out, African-American voters voted in greater proportions than they did in 2008. Right. So they were skewing things. It's interesting that they claimed everything was skewed against them until the polling, the actual real votes came in, and they figured the whole country was skewed against them. You know, they have got to be, pollsters have to be honest. And if they're not telling the truth, if they are being biased themselves, then campaigns can go seriously off track, and that's what happened.
I had Romney people say to me, oh, well, the youth aren't as motivated this time. They won't turn out in these numbers. Just facts that they'd come up with on their own. And I would ask for data to support it, and they would have assumptions, essentially. So does this campaign prove a triumph of data, you know, the Nate Silver data, the Barack Obama data, and then everyone will adopt this and focus on numbers and reality and not just assumptions?
So it's not the certitude of the numbers in the Obama campaign came not just from the polling data. And I go into some depth at this. This is where you get into the analytics. They had the polling data, but then they had hundreds of thousands of real-life contacts. Right. So they would target those contacts. It's not like they knocked on every door, but they tested their modeling by knocking on certain doors and calling up certain numbers of people to test the 45 to 55, 65 range in their model. And each time they got another 2,000 responses, 10,000 responses back. They reworked the model. And so, and each of those models were already built on thousands of data points from previous election data. Had they voted? What was the party affiliation by state? Overlaying it with commercial data. You know, what magazines do you subscribe to? Building up that profile to get that 100 range. So the polling data they could then test. And they could test their propositions. So the whole 2 years was a testing of the model. That's very different from a Nate Silver modeling, by the way. Mm-hmm. He uses some statistical analysis, but he didn't have any insight into what that data looked like. Mm-hmm. And it was only because they could test the polling and the modeling with the real-life contact that it worked. So every time the Romney people said, well, you know, these state-by-state offices that Obama has are useless. They're meaningless, right? For a start, they're empty because there's no one in there. There were no one in there because they were knocking on doors all the time. And the fact they had so many offices meant they could knock on more doors. And they learned that. Here's the irony. They learned all of that. They built that from watching the Bush model in 2004. Mm-hmm. So here was the Obama people who built on Bush in 2004. In 2008, they built it again. For 2012, by the time you get to 2012, the Republicans have forgotten how they made the secret sauce in the first place.
Exactly. You mentioned various members of the staff emailing you. Someone would like to know, do you know if President Obama has read your book, or is at least aware of it, has been told about it, briefed on it, given a digest?
So I haven't had this story. On the first book, they got copies and were reading it on Air Force One, and he grabbed a copy and started reading it. He's writing his own book, right? He's writing his own journals, and for a lot of them who are doing this, and this was another complicating factor in writing a book this time around, people writing their own books don't like to get polluted by someone else's books, and they get infuriated by it, and I totally understand that.
And they want to save the best bits for themselves.
Exactly. It's not that long since the book came out, and I did not send them advance copies, mostly because I didn't have them. The truth is that, and this is a bit of a dodge, but I know the inner circle very, very well. I know exactly who would have contacted me if the president had a message to convey about all the ample coverage that there has been about the book since its launch last week. And it's been a conspicuous absence. So I know that his inner circle is fully aware of this book. What's fascinating as well is hearing how some of the people inside think they know who leaked against them. Mm-hmm. And they're all of them fingering very different and very misguided people. Not misguided people, they're misguided about who they think it is. So no, I don't know that he's read it. No, I don't know his reaction. He's got a lot on his plate right now, so I doubt that he reads many books at all. And if he does, he tries to avoid nonfiction entirely. Are they aware at the highest level in the White House about this book? Oh, yes. They've made their feelings very clear to me.
Maybe this is on his Christmas reading list, you know, or one of his vacation getaways.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Just a reminder for our listeners, our guest is Richard Wolff of MSNBC and MSNBC.com, author of The Message. We're discussing the Obama campaign and administration. So who does the president listen to most these days? Who has his ear at this point in that administration?
His wife.
Apart from Michelle.
Who has his ear the most? Look, he has a great relationship now for the first time with his chief of staff, who is Dennis McDonough, one of his longest aides. You know, one of the interesting things is that as presidents stay in the White House longer and longer, their circle shrinks, and it's very true with this White House and this president. He didn't have a very big circle to begin with, very centralized, and here he is with the best possible relationship with someone who worked with him in his Senate office from the very get-go of his time in Washington. That speaks volumes about him, about how tough it has been being in the White House through this period. You know, Dennis McDonough is a veteran of the Senate, of foreign policy, He has a good relationship with people on the Hill, but this past few weeks on foreign policy with the Hill have been very, very rocky. Mm. So Dennis McDonough, Dan Pfeiffer, who's also been with him from the very start of actually his first presidential election, he's also become the replacement for Axelrod and then David Plouffe. Right. So those two people are very influential, but Valerie Jarrett, a friend from Chicago, Michelle Obama, those really are the tightest group.
So the core of the original group
hasn't really
essentially.
Changed. Hasn't changed.
A lot of questions about 2016.
Yep.
I don't want to spend too much time on it, but let's combine a few of them here. What is the reselling of Hillary Clinton going to look like?
Great question. And who's going to do it?
That is a very good question. And when will that begin? I think it has
already.
It has
already, right.
What do you think that's going to be?
I think she... I think she's incredibly well-placed for 2016, which really starts, at the end of 2014, which really starts about now.
Mm-hmm.
She has a very fine needle to thread, which is how do you maintain the Obama coalition, but also signal to the country that she is a departure from Obama? You have to play off the incumbent. And that was very hard for Al Gore, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
She can't really say it's a third time. She could credibly say, look, I am my own person. I've had plenty of differences of opinion. But she's also got to say what she stands for that's different. How is her agenda going to be different? How could she break Washington's fever more than this president has? Because that's clearly been a frustration for everyone. So how would she get things done? What would she get done differently? I think she has to define those. And it's not going to be good enough to say, as she did in 2008, change plus experience. She's mm-hmm. going to face a challenge from the left, right? There is going to be one young, annoying whippersnapper on the left who says, you're the candidate of Wall Street and big business and the establishment, and you're getting on, and I'm the person.
20 years ago. And,
right, and I'm the person who's the future, and you're Lawrence Summers, and I'm...
Mm-hmm.
I know, Janet Yellen, which is a great slogan. Right? That should be a bumper sticker right there.
Who do you think that dynamic is going to happen? Who do you think that might... I mean, there are plenty of mainstream Hillary surrogates if she doesn't run, but who do you think that from the left...
I think it's probably going to be a governor, but look, at this point in 2000, 2005,
right.
Would you have said Barack Obama?
Of course not.
I mean, that's just preposterous. Frankly, it was preposterous in 2006 and for most of 2007.
Yeah, that's true.
So... We don't know who that person is.
Do you think there's any chance that she will not run?
No.
I don't either.
That was simple. That was easy.
I agree with you. She's already running as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
And what about on the Republican side? One person wants to know, is it Hillary versus Christie? I don't think so personally, but I'd be curious, what do you think? It's a little too soon for me to go out on that limb, but what do you think?
I think once again... Honestly, the Democratic agenda is not going to be that much in question. Yes, mm-hmm. there's going to be a question about the sort of the rhetorical edge with which you talk about business and corporations. Honestly, is anyone really going to even an Elizabeth Warren, right, who's supposed to be the sort of figurehead for people who want to get tough on Wall Street? Honestly, we're not talking about socialists here
mm-hmm.
at all. So the range of debate in the Democratic Party is very limited compared to the Republican side. And the Republican side, each of these leading figures, and Chris Christie is one of them, Rand Paul is another,
mm-hmm.
Rick Santorum is another, each of them are going to speak for distinct, very vocal, really quite robust voting blocks within the Republican Party. Watching that play out is going to be fascinating. It'll make for great TV for MSNBC. And I think there is a struggle for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. You know, Rick Santorum, speaking for Christian conservatives, is owed something because he was the last man standing against Mitt Romney, and the Republican Party always gives something to the last man standing. Chris Christie is your sort of Wall Street Republican. It's New Jersey, but... And he's got some of the feistiness there, so he can cover some of the aggression that the grassroots have, but all the energy is with the libertarian Tea Party side. So, you could even have a fracturing of that. You could have the Tea Party Ted Cruz against the Libertarian Rand Paul. Which of those candidates can unite those? Right, the genius of the Bushes was to be, you know, the business candidate, but also speak the language of the social conservatives. Who can do all of that? I'm not convinced it's Chris Christie.
I'm actually looking forward much more to covering the Republican primaries in 16.
I think it's going to be.
The Democrats could just be Hillary and it's over. The Democrats, you know, with Rubio in there, who knows why.
Don't think it will.
No, I don't either.
But I think both sides, it's going to be completely enthralling.
You talked about the reception to the book, generally positive, but yeah. Some of the things that you report have been denied by certain people, and people say you're making things up. It's not true. Some people tweeted questions to me today saying, that book's a work of fiction. How can you go on stage with the man? So how do you respond?
How can you go on stage?
And I said, I love interviewing authors of fiction. What do you mean?
Yeah.
So how do you respond to some of the criticism to say, this can't be true or this is wrong? I never said that.
That challenge has really come from the sort of diehard Obama fans. And I understand why they would choose not to believe any of this stuff. I have to say to those people, this book really isn't about President Obama himself. It's about the team that was trying to get him reelected. And so they have to distinguish between reporting about the president and reporting about the team. So just not wanting to believe something doesn't mean to say it's fiction, right? I don't want to hear anything, so then it's not true. Mm-hmm. It's not really a credible position. What has been challenged as not true? I heard from an advertising agency in St. Louis that I write about that taped a radio ad about the president, which got pulled down. And the radio ad it was like a jingle, and it had a group singing the phrase, as it was described to me, and you can hear it on the web, as it was described to me by one of the very few African-American campaign aides, as we've got yo back, right? Mm. And I forgive my accent and everything else, but the ad agency said, it didn't say yo back, it said you're back, and that's an outrageous insult and everything else. Well, I was careful to say this was what this African-American aide, senior aide, said it was, and you can hear it, and they pulled it down because they felt this was not the kind of tone that President Obama would say. So there's a factual dispute, but it's a kind of, it's an interpretational dispute between people who were inside the campaign. David Axelrod insists that he was not pushed out early from the inner circle to go to Chicago, out of the White House, and that he'd always made a promise to head back to Chicago to his wife. I expressed that in the book. Mm-hmm. And as a book author, when you have a number of people saying, yeah, he was pushed out and he found it very difficult, and you hear about tensions that come out because he felt on the outside, your job is to describe that in some nuance and some complexity, and to place the best interpretation you can on it. It pains me that people say that that's a work of fiction. Books are, they have layers to them. They're not tweets. Mm-hmm. So if you want to judge a book by its tweets, then to me that's even worse than judging a book by its cover. I actually think it's better to judge a book by its cover.
Well said. Is there too much focus on message and theme and media control and not enough on policy or ideas? Is it just the nature of the beast? We're stuck with it?
If the Obama campaign in 2012 had been about policy formation, I would have written about it. Their policy team was not formulating policy. Their policy team was working out how to describe policy. They were messaging policy. So I wrote the story that took place. That's what they spent their hundreds of millions of dollars on. It wasn't on policy experts. I wish it had been. Maybe it would have been a better campaign for it.
In modern politics, though, is there too much on polling and message?
Is there too much? It's obscene. Yeah. I mean, it's obscene amounts of money. This is grotesque. How many hospitals could you build with this money? I understand why people are fired up and they give money to campaigns, but honestly, if you want to change the country, if you give you know, as many dollars to a campaign as you give to an activist group on the ground that cleans up trash or builds schools or paints schools, you could accomplish both goals. Of course, people don't do that, and it pains me that they don't do that. I think we should have free airtime in this country. I think the idea of, you know, you're not going to stop ads, but if you make them so boring because they're free and they go on for hours and hours, I mean, that's how they do it in the UK, right? It's not, you can't stop people buying ads, but if you give them like 10 minutes of airtime, nobody watches. They come on TV and it's free. And after the first 30 seconds, everyone stands up and has a cup of coffee or a cup of tea. And, they, you know, it's the greatest thing. Make it boring.
We might both be unemployed if the ads were free.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Forget that idea.
Given how much money CBS gets from the political ads, in my case.
Well, I... Okay.
It's a nice idea, though.
Yeah.
Shut up. A question from the audience. You cracked the inner circles of the Obama administration.
Yep.
Could you offer advice to policy advocates on how they, too, might at least dialogue with these inner circles?
Oh, so that's a great question. One of the great images of Obama as a community organizer was exactly that question. How do you penetrate the circles of power? And there's a board that he has, and he's sort of scribbling on it as he's training other community organizers. And it's about how power is wielded, and how do you get to decision makers as an organizer? And, you know, it talks about the friends and the donors and, you know, the media. And I think you have to attack it from all sorts of different angles. But there is very much a sort of circle of influence around any level of decision makers that, whether you're a journalist or an activist, that you kind of have to penetrate and figure out who has the influence and who's got their ear, and then work on that. Now, unfortunately, there are lots of people who also figure that out on the inside, and they make money from that, right? Mm-hmm. They make the introductions, and they get people to pay them for it, which is basically corrupt. It also happens to be legal. So I think it's hard for activist groups when they're up against corporations that are paying money for that kind of access. This White House, this administration has actually opened the doors to many activist groups because they do feel that, at least on their side, they have a purpose. So you have to find the person within that circle who speaks for those issues and has that sort of penetration.
One of the biggest disappointments for many Obama supporters is that this does seem as corporate a presidency as many of those that have come before, and someone in the audience would like to know why the president is relying so much on insiders who benefit from the revolving door, as they put it, like Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, and what is your take on Larry Summers and not going to be Fed chairman?
Well, I think Larry Summers is undoubtedly a brilliant mind. He is very abrasive and has got many, many enemies inside the administration, inside Washington. And those enemies delighted in essentially taking down his candidacy in quite a public way and not a very seemly way either. I do think he's too close to Wall Street, actually, and I think that was reflected in some of the policy debates as they played out. This president didn't know much about the economy when he came into the worst financial crisis in two or three generations. And he was very reliant on people who knew something about Wall Street and the economy to essentially tutor him. And Larry Summers became his sort of economics professor, and these briefings were like economic tutorials. That meant Larry Summers could skew the argument to the great frustration of more of the sort of progressive economists around the president. So the president was reliant on these people with close ties to Wall Street. He was also reliant on, frankly, rescuing Wall Street. So he had a president who had to rescue Wall Street as much as he hated them, because without the banks, this crisis would have been even worse. So they had to revive the banks. And then the banks bounced back much quicker than anyone thought. And instead of being grateful and humble, they acted like Wall Street banks and proceeded to screw us again. And so, you know, they couldn't predict that. They couldn't predict that the banks would go from being desperate for public help to spending hundreds of millions of dollars to lobby against the federal government. You know, that's who they are.
Do you think the president, as a matter of, he wants to surround himself with people with whom he's comfortable, Larry Summers, as opposed to Janet Yellen, who many of us know in San Francisco? She was president of the San Francisco Fed, but he doesn't know
that. Also a brilliant mind. Look, no president likes to get bounced into things. And so there's a sort of, he's my man or my woman, and I'm going to stick with them. He had it with Susan Rice as well. I think Janet Yellen's a great choice for the Fed. I worked at the Financial Times for many years. She's well known in economic circles, very well respected. I don't know what the resistance was other than ego and power and the perception of power.
Well, Larry Summers says women, what, they don't know anything about science or math, so she obviously can't have a job.
The president could do better with women generally, so he should embrace some high-profile women in his broader administration.
How distorted a picture do you think voters get of the candidates and the process and eventually the president? How far is the image they're sold from the actual truth?
You know, we used to fret about this. I write about this. I really enjoyed writing a chapter about the history of ads and ad making because we used to fret about cornflakes campaigns, about packaging up politicians like breakfast cereal, and now we don't. And I think we should look at that, actually. How far away is it? It's a long way. Packaging and messaging is not reality. And we like to think of ourselves as being very sophisticated because, you know, we're on Twitter and Facebook and smartphones. We're not. We're just as easily manipulated as we ever have been, maybe more so. And I think it would be healthy for us to say, how real is this? How honest is this? Not just fact-checking the ads, but how are we being manipulated? And I know that we've got a whole debate about civil liberties, but part of civil liberties is, are we being suckered? When a campaign spends, and I'm not talking about the Obama campaign, I'm just generally, when politicians spend hundreds of millions of dollars, they're not doing it because the consultants just tell them it's a good idea. They're doing it because it works. And so, you know, why do we let it work? We think all of these ads come out of nowhere. There's a long history of people selling us stuff. I love getting into where does the American dream and the sale of the American dream come from? Because all of these ads are telling you the same thing. Vote for someone and America will be a better place and you'll get your dreams come true. That comes out of something. That comes out of, you know, you buy Listerine and you'll be more popular. I mean, Listerine was a terrible product. It had been around for years, and then he invented halitosis, and then people bought Listerine. No, it's true. And so they invent problems, and then they sell us a product to go fix the invented problem. And that's what advertising has been for years and years. I shouldn't say this because we'll be out of a job again. But we should look at campaigns like that, too, and I don't think we do nearly. We're not as sophisticated as we think we are.
Well, unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where we're down to our very last question. You said earlier there won't be a fourth book, but I'll ask you anyway. There's 3 more years of the Obama presidency to go. Certainly there'll be more to write about, and you can burnish your reputation as the chronicler of the Obama years.
That's really for someone else.
Is there another book in mind that you would like to write about instead? And isn't what you just talked about
Beach
part
vacations.
Of the value? Part of the value of this sort of book is to open people's eyes and show them what the reality actually is.
Is there another book? Once you're bitten by this, it's hard to stop. Right now, it's easy to stop for me. So I enjoyed doing this book much more than I thought. The story was very different from the one I thought and the one I'd been led to believe was the case. You never say never, but for me, I'm looking forward to a long pause.
All right, well, our thanks to Richard Wolff, MSNBC.com, executive editor, author of The Message, The Reselling of President Obama. We also thank our audience here and on the radio and on the Internet. I also just want to remind everyone who is here that copies of Mr. Wolff's book are on sale in the lobby. He will sign them for you as soon as we're done, and appreciate you letting him get out there as quickly as possible before you do. I'm Doug Sovereign of KCBS Radio, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.